Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is July 6th, Tuesday, 2021. This month is already flying by, Dave.
Hey, welcome to the dog days.
Boy, I'll tell you. And is summer almost over? Seems that way. But anyway, hope everyone had a great 4th. I know Butch did a program, live program yesterday, so I do thank him for that. He said it was an awesome show, so I'm assuming it is. He always does a great job. So, and we're live today, so let's go ahead and get started with the market report. And the market report today, gold was up $5 of the New York spot price after market, $1,797. We had a high of 1,816. So, still higher, but not as strong as it was first thing this morning. Silver was down 34 cents at $26.23. Platinum was down 4 at $1,096. Palladium was down 25 at $2,882. The USDX was stronger by 0.26 at 92.52. Crude oil was down. I guess OPEC canceled their meeting, so it was down $1.45 at 73.71. Paper markets today, well, the Dow was down 200 points. Earlier it was down 400. I don't know if it went past there, but 208 right now to the negative. 34,577. The S&P was down 8 at 4,343. NASDAQ was up 24 points at 14,663. Let's go ahead and see what Asia markets did. They were all negative across the board. They were all down just slightly under 1%. Asia, the only one positive was the Nikkei, and the other ones were just down slightly. 10-year yield on the 10-year bond was 1.35, so that really dropped today, 1.356 compared to what it was. So there you go. Rates can't rise. They need to stay lower, right, Dave?
Righto.
I guess we're going to get started by talking about service providers. They expanded in June by less than what was expected as a measure of employment contracted, reflecting the employer's struggle to attract workers in industries like hotels and restaurants. The Institute for Supply Management Services Index fell to 60.1 last month, from the record in May, which was 64. And just like with anything else, readings above 50 indicate the expansion. Orders and business activity also settled back. The June figure compared with economist 63.5 median projection. So the ISM's measure of order backlogs, that was the highest in the group's data back to 1997. At the same time, an index of services employment dropped to the lowest level this year, slumping to 49.3 from 55 a month earlier. So Anthony Knives, chair of the ISM Service Businesses Survey Committee, said challenges with material shortages, inflation, but we have no inflation, so they tell us, I'll whisper like the president does. Logistics and employment resources continue to be an impediment to business conditions. 16 of 18 service industries reported growth in June. And yeah, hey, led by arts, entertainment, and recreation. Real estate and agriculture reported decreases, Dave.
Hey, that was a good whisper impersonation.
Was that a good impersonation? Yeah.
I hope you're sitting in your studio, though, with your aviator shades on.
Well, I will have them and get them real quick.
Part of the full uniform. There were several observations made by the different sections that I won't go over. But there is one note here that I think is worth mentioning is that supplier delivery times remained elevated because of truck availability, slower rail services, port congestion, and container shortages. And a separate gauge of inventory sentiment dropped to a record low, showing more service providers seeing their stockpiles as too lean. And last but not least, the index of prices paid for materials actually fell slightly, suggesting that while still elevated, the acceleration in cost pressures may be starting to cool. That's according to this article. I think it's a tad premature to make that kind of observation, even speculative, as that statement is, Melody.
Well, you know, something that's rising a lot is the cost of rental homes and, you know, squeezing the finances of your low-income households. To be a matter of fact, the median national rent climbed 9.2% in the first half of 2021. A part of the increase reflects a bounce back in prices that dropped earlier in the pandemic. The real estate firm says rents are now higher than they had stayed on their pre-pandemic track. I didn't know they've lowered rates during last year. I didn't hear any. I didn't remember reporting and reading about lower rents.
You and me both.
So
that may have been here and there, you know, as a result, you know, in lieu of, you know, forcing tenants into forbearance programs, but it certainly wasn't big news.
No.
I agree with you.
No, the only thing I could say is perhaps, you know, when you hear about landlords trying to work with their renters to, you know, survive, they might have lowered the rents to help them out and so forth, but by no means was it a across the board, across the country type of where people lowered their rental rates. So, but they're still rising. Just at the time, you know, when we see a lot of the number of lease renewals fall due to locking millions of tenants into bigger monthly bills, I don't know. It's, but both, Fannie Mae and Freddie suggest renters are braced for further hikes of 7 to 10%. That's a lot in the coming year. And higher rents are the kind of price increases that they never get reversed. Rarely. And unless you have a major depression, that'll lower them. That'll lower them really quick. But anything else you'd like to add to that, Dave?
Well, I think the most significant point of this particular story, that one, because rents are harder to decrease, in terms of the Fed, how the Fed's viewing things, it could mean that the current spike in inflation will not be transitory, that these rents in particular, this is going to be an industry where we see rents continuing to increase higher than a lot of other parts of the U.S. economy. And, you know, for example, I mean, as one person, an economist, Sarah House, said, you know, when you're signing a lease, on average, it's probably for a year or so. And, you know, the Fed and other economists are talking about inflation in terms of 6 months or less. So that's the important point, I believe, that listeners should take from this article.
There's another place where we're going to see some rising costs, and that's back to school expenses. According to a new survey from accounting firm KPMG, consumers predict a 9% year-over-year increase in their back to school spending. Last year they anticipated spending $247, this year $268. According to the report, a leading reason for increased spending is expectations that items will be more expensive this back-to-school season. Among respondents planning to spend more per child, 39% believe things will cost more in 2021. According to KPMG, numerous products are seeing a spike in prices that's driven by a combination of the, you know, supply shocks in manufacturing, the strong demand for goods, including certain school shopping categories.
Yeah, clothing prices are one of them, showing a reported 1.9% increase, which seems low, but the sudden and widespread shift to remote schooling at the end of 2019 or the 2019 school year, which in many cases would have been early last summer, its continuation into 2020 mean that many parents are still competing to scoop up these high demand, limited inventory items, especially things like computers and desks. And we know the global supply chain bottlenecks and technology and furniture, for example, continue to make that matter worse. Now, the headline CPIU saw a year-over-year increase in May of 5%, according to the government. Actual inflation, applying methodologies used in the 80s and 90s, is more than double that, Melody. Even the Bureau of Labor Statistics' understated findings imply that the U.S. is witnessing its highest level of inflation since the Great Recession.
Golly gee. Well, here's interesting. We've talked about, you know, central banks across the world adding to their gold reserves. Well, I guess they're at it again. They continue to do it. Central banks from Serbia to Thailand, they've been adding to their gold holdings. Ghana recently announced plans for purchases. Now, and again, why do they want to add gold to their holdings? Well, it's the threat of accelerating inflation as it looms. Recovery and global trade provides the firepower to make purchases for diversifications. The Bank of Ghana said its plans to implement a gold purchase program designed to purchase locally produced gold. And Ruby's buying some, too. Its vice president, Bawumia, said the benefits of having a healthy amount of physical gold in a country's reserves are varied and enormous, including assuring of the value of the local currency. The bank's decision, he indicated, is a game changer. You have Taiwan was the biggest buyer, according, adding an additional 47 tons in May and accounting for a whopping 82% of total net purchases for the month. We have Turkey. They also increased its gold reserves by almost 9 tons during the month, bringing in their official sector reserves to 415 tons. Brazil increased gold reserves by 12 tons, in addition, its first addition since November of 2012, Dave.
Yeah, I think there might be a typo in that that one country. I think it's Thailand as opposed to Taiwan. But overall, gold reserves now stand at 79 tons. It's 1% of all reserves, which is the highest level since November 2000. You have Kazakhstan. I love that name, although it does remind me every time I see or hear the word of that insane movie character Borat. But Kazakhstan, Poland, and India were the other notable buyers during the month. That's according to the World Gold Council. National Bank of Serbia said long-term gold is the most significant guardian and guarantor of protection against inflationary and other forms of financial risks. Their president recently announced the country's central bank intends to boost its gold holdings to 50 tons, up from 36. Now, also, there's James Steele, precious metal analyst at the investment bank HSBC, said if a central bank's looking at diversifying, gold is a marvelous way of moving out of the dollar without selecting another currency. So gold, central bank's net purchases during the month overall around the world was 43% above the year-to-date monthly average before then, Melody.
Well, you know, in the beginning of the program, we talked about oil and the drop in oil and how the OPEC had canceled their plans. But so it seems like they plunged into another crisis. You have this bitter infighting. I don't know if it's anything new between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And but it does raise questions about the future of the energy alliance. OPEC and its partners, as we know, some of the world's most powerful oil producers, abandoned plans to reconvene yesterday after last week's meeting unexpectedly failed to broker a deal on oil production policy. The group has not set a new date to resume these talks. So there's, you know, that means no agreement has been reached on a possible increase in crude production beyond the end of July. That's leaving oil markets in a state of limbo, just as the global fuel demand recovers from this ongoing pandemic. So Halima Croft, head of the global commodity strategy at RBC Capital Markets, said back-channel talks reportedly are continuing, but questions about the UAE's commitment to remaining in OPEC will likely grow in the coming days. So,
tell you, if they're back channel, Melody, they ought to have Jared involved. He's always good in those backroom negotiations.
Well, they always have their issues, and they all kind of never tell the truth, and you know, but. What else you got to add to this?
Well, this is an interesting development that this dispute now is so public, and you know that words like bitter are being used in mainstream media accounts. I mean, I agree with you that these disputes go on all the time, and. You know, we've known of Saudi Arabia and UAE disagreements over these production numbers at least for a year, but it's interesting to see it raised to this level. I mean, it's interesting too that you know the White House has announced it's pushing for a compromise solution. And another analyst, a partner at, again, Capital, John Kilduff, said the OPEC solidarity dissolved today.
Well, this first segment has dissolved, I guess. We're heading into the first break of the program today. We'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival. We will find you at
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Sign up for the weekly newsletter. One didn't go out this week because of the holiday. They'll resume next week. And it's a great little newsletter. So it's free, and we only do it by email. We don't mail any hard copies out. So if you don't have a computer, well, maybe you can go to the library and pull it up. So I think I'm finally out of my spring fever mode. It hit me bad this year, and so we're back at work. I think July is going to be a little bit of a quiet month, unless something happens. During the summer, things begin to pop a little bit more come August. The new coins, the new design, excited about the new designs coming out in the American Gold Eagle and the American Silver Eagle. We should be getting them. The Mint is delivering them on the 7th. Give us a week or so for us to get them, and they'll be shipped out for all of those who have put in orders for the new design. So there's a lot of exciting things in the gold market this year, and I think it's going to continue. We've both seen gold build a strong level, no lower than 1700, and silver seems to be holding on to that 25, 26 level. So those are all good signs. And as we talk about inflation, I can't imagine prices going down anytime soon. And it's, you know, all we hear about is the great economy. It's like, folks, the world economies were shut down. It's not like we had a great economy and then all of a sudden, you know, millions of jobs were created above that. People were sent home. They couldn't work. And it's not that the businesses couldn't keep them going. I mean, we were in a recession, so it's kind of hard to figure out the difference between the recession and how the pandemic really hit when the world economy shut down. So so just buckle up. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And let's see. Let's go ahead and talk about AMC. It's another example of a dysfunctional market. Let us count the ways. I mean, we tell you every day. AMC Entertainment said this morning that it has tabled a proposal that would have asked its shareholders to allow the movie theater chain to issue up to 25 million more shares, valued at about $1.25 billion. Filing with the SEC, the company said the proposal has been withdrawn from an agenda for its upcoming annual meeting of stockholders. Not coincidentally, AMC shares jumped more than 5% in early trade, just on the news. And, of course, the CEO, Adam Aron, announced the news on Twitter. It's no secret, I think, shareholders should authorize 25 million more AMC shares. Or what you think is important to us. Many yes, many no. AMC does not want to proceed with such a split. So I don't know, Dave.
I do. Your Biden whisper is much better than Adam Aron's is.
Okay. So, anyway, what else is on there about AMC?
Well, you know, I mean, this craziness in the retail market, the Reddits the world. It's, I mean, AMC shares up close to 2,400% year to date. The company's market cap is up to close to $26 billion. And this is a company, remember, that's had literally empty movie theaters across the country for over a year. And it's just now getting, it's not getting back to normal, just now reopening. A couple of recent blockbusters have made some chains and movie makers optimistic that things are going to now turn around. But, geez, come on. Only in a dysfunctional market could something like this happen.
Well, you know, speaking of dysfunction, you know, in Amazon's new CEO, Andy Jassy, he was granted 61,000 shares of company stock yesterday when he replaced Jeff Bezos. These shares will vest over a period of 10 years. Some warped mainstream media says the grant represents a financial acknowledgement of a high priority leadership change for one of the world's top technology companies. You know, I mean, I guess this is a problem that so many have that, I mean, here's a company, it's a successful company. Amazon was founded in 1994. Bezos is the richest person in the world. He's worth close to $200 billion. So how much is those 61,000 shares worth, Dave? $214 million?
They're way up there. $214 million, based on Friday's closing price of about a little over
$3,500. Yeah.
It's crazy. But he owns 0.02% of Amazon stock before that. Now, that doesn't seem like an awful lot, but guess how much that's worth? $300 million. So all of a sudden, the new CEO is worth, well, at least $514 million. A pretty good start on his race to be the next billionaire.
True, but I mean, that's quite of a... I mean, all you have to do is delegate, but I mean, it's a lot to delegate. I mean, it's if he runs the company, runs it well, then he's worth it. I mean, it's all perspective, right?
Oh, well, sure. Absolutely. Okay. It's all perspective. I mean, look at it this way. Here's one perspective from the median Amazon employee. Median annual pay. Yes, thank you, Molly. It is. It does make you want to throw up. Median annual pay for all Amazon employees before the pandemic was $35,000. Means half made more, half made less. Now Jassy's new $214 million deal, you know, equates to about $21 million, $21.4 a year. $411,000 a week, and just shy of $59,000 a day. So put another way, the daily value of Jassy's promotion bonus is 68% more than the median annual pay of all Amazon employees. And I would humbly suggest that that's not bad work if you can get it. Notwithstanding the fact that I'm sure he'll earn his keep.
I'm sure he will. No, I mean, then if he doesn't, somebody else will come in. But again, you're looking at, you know, just a very huge company. And that's maybe part of the problem. You know, it's just like maybe the company shouldn't be that huge, you know, but people work hard. They deserve it, though. So, I mean,
so do the people earning $35,000 a year.
True. But I guess you have your dog at work today, too.
My doggie is at work today inside in the cool studio.
Yes.
My elder lady is panting like it's, I don't know,
1995.
Like we're on the equator.
Yes, we hear. So I just wanted to let the listeners know that it was coming from your little doggy. How old is How old is she?
Molly is 15.
15 years old. So.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll be heading into a break here pretty soon. The defense, you know, speaking of the Department of Defense announced this morning that it's calling off a $10 billion cloud contract. That was the subject of a legal battle involving Amazon and Microsoft, but is also announcing a new contract and soliciting proposals from both cloud service providers, where both companies will likely clinch a reward. Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure. Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure, or JEDI. The deal has become one of the most tangled contracts for the Department of Defense in recent memory. The fight over a cloud computing project does not appear to be completely over yet. The Pentagon said that it still needs enterprise-scale cloud capability and announced a new multi-vendor contract known as the Joint Warfighter Cloud Capability. For short, JWCC.
I mean,
it's just a good grief. Who makes up these names?
Oh, well, a bureaucracy of 2 million people.
Yeah, and they probably get way overpaid to sit there and make up names, too.
It'd be interesting if there were an acronym contest, which organization, public or private, would win for the most acronyms within its organization. I suspect the Pentagon would be way up there. Well, the Pentagon said it does plan to solicit new proposals from both Amazon and Microsoft for this JWIC contract, adding that they are the only cloud service providers right now, anyway, that can meet their needs. The lucrative JEDI contract, which we talked about a couple of times in this program, was intended to modernize the Pentagon's IT operations for over 10 years, or around 10 years. Pentagon officials said that the litigation itself between Amazon, Microsoft, and the Department of Defense was not the main reason for the shifted approach. The agency said it expects the new JWIC contract being the multi-billions, though it's still determining its maximum value.
Well, again, I guess it's back to the infrastructure plan. Today, there was a group of House members, both sides, that endorsed the bipartisan infrastructure framework that was crafted by senators in the White House, but as usual, potentially complicated its path to passage along the way. The 58-member Problem Solvers Caucus. Yeah, it just irritates me. So that it strongly, you know, it does. I mean, come on, people. Good
God. I know. It gives rise to the question, well, what about the other 300 and some members? Are they not problem solvers?
I know. And it's all that. Well, never mind. Don't get me started. It's first day back. Don't get me started. but they support. They strongly support the Senate proposal, of course. If the group's 29 GOP members vote for the plan, House Democrats have room to lose support from the skeptical progressives and still pass the $1.2 trillion framework. But, you know, I don't know. It's just, you know, I don't know what to call. I don't know what to say about it, Dave.
Well, I think the mantra should be another day, another drama. That's, you know, I mean, what else can you say? I mean, it just goes with, we're using the D word today, dysfunction, ladies and gentlemen. And I mean, who knows where this is going to end up until it ends and something is either passed or not. You know, the Senate plans to move next week when it returns from its July 4th recess. Chuck Schumer, the majority leader there, said he will start votes on the bipartisan framework. I don't even think the bill's in writing yet, but also a budget.
They never read anything, so I guess they don't have to put
a 2021-2022 budget resolution that some say would allow the D's to approve a second larger bill without our support. R as in Republican, that is, not O-U-R. Again, Melody, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of changing dynamics, it seems, on almost a daily basis. Purposely, it seems, to throw citizens off to keep us at bay while the special interests get their wish list vetted and through. It doesn't seem like a good way to do the business of the people, does it?
No, of course not. And the thing of it is, this is they're not going to get this. They probably won't get anything done for infrastructure until after September 30th. And then if the markets or something going on, then they'll push it through as an emergency type situation. Because I think that in the past year, and I don't think people are ready to have another $1.2 trillion bill go through after the last year we've had, what, $5
trillion?
Six. $6 trillion. So, I mean, we'll see. But, hey, if it's smooth sailing and there's no rough waters that we're in right now, they'll ride it out until we come to those rough waters, and then they can get anything passed and they can throw in all their pork and everything else. And but anyway, that's just my thoughts.
Well, no, it's not just yours, and it's a we'll call it a studious perception or what have you. A lot of not everybody, but a lot of Washington outsiders who aren't part of the madness. And from what I hear and read, there's a good bit of the insiders, too, that tell it like it is in this respect anyway. It's just that they're so befuddled, I think, by it that, you know, I don't know if it's a matter that they just come to expect it anymore, if they're too cynical to question the leadership. But folks like us in this program, Melody, we continue to tell it like we see it, and it ain't pretty.
No, it isn't. And we're heading into a break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of client orders this segment. You can call her at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. Now, Dan Amos writes that gold's recent sell-off looked familiar in that it resembled the types of gold sell-offs that occurred when the Fed talked about tightening its loose policy for years in the mid-2010s. Well, it sure talked a good game, Amos observed, but when it came time to really test how much tightening the debt-saturated economy could handle, well, by late 2018, the Powell Fed folded like a cheap suit. In fact, the Fed not only felt compelled to reverse the slow, wimpy tightening that it had implemented in 3 years prior, it also had to restart QE in the fall of 2019 when it became clear that the yield curve wasn't steep enough to absorb a tidal wave of treasuries hitting the market at the time. This reminds us that by late 2019, the repo market seized up. Quote, it threatened to push short-term rates in the money market above the Fed's policy rate, unquote. So the Fed implemented QE Infinity, where it boosted the volume of repurchase loans to ease funding conditions and rising rates in the Treasury market. When the COVID crash arrived last March, it provided cover to slash short-term interest rates back to virtually zero. With a slightly wider yield curve, primary dealers in the Treasury market could once again fund themselves at near zero rate to absorb the heavy volumes in Treasury auctions. Yay, Fed! And just in case Treasury auctions threatened to get out of hand, the Fed stood by with a steady, reliable bid for at least $80 billion per month in treasuries and another $40 billion per month in agency mortgage-backed securities. Yay, Fed! The $120 billion per month in QE has flooded Wall Street and its money markets with so many excess reserves that the system temporarily ran out of safe securities or bank deposits to park them. Rates on treasury bills and notes were on the verge of going below 0%. In fact, real rates, including inflation, have been below zero for some time now. But the Fed wants to avoid nominal negative rates because it's damaging the money market fund. So it implemented a large reverse repurchase agreement program. To wit, over the past 2.5 months, the Fed's reverse repo facility expanded from practically zero to $813 billion. Now, complicating this, Amos argues, was the demand for reverse repo facility and the Treasury Department's drawing down its Treasury General Account with the Fed. Now, during this drawdown, the supply of new T-bills at auction has temporarily fallen to new levels, low levels, that is. The mismatch between the Fed's QE and a temporary shortage of Treasuries is what nearly drove the short-term rates to below zero, nominally. Amos's key takeaway of all this is that the Fed is terrified of changing its messaging on QE or interest rates. It just doesn't want to pop, he says, what it is finally recognizing as bubble activities on Wall Street. This because rather than stop or even taper the volume of QE to limit the glut of reserves on the money market or to prevent negative rates, the Fed has chosen instead to roll out the this large reverse repo program to temporarily sterilize all the reserves that had printed in the past. Also, the Fed likely wants to maintain a heavy pace of QE to ensure that when the Treasury auctions ramp back up to fund future federal budget deficits, for example, there will be enough buying power at today's low yields to prevent a repeat of the fall 2019 burps in that repo market. The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that federal deficits will remain extremely high. Some say for some time to come, others say forever. So, to fund these deficits at rates that the government and the broader financial system can afford, Amas says continued Fed QE will be promoted as necessary, which is probably to say it will always be promoted because the Fed will, you know, if not forever, for a long time to come. Then he presents this hypothetical scenario, which I found fascinating. A Fed eases aggressively during a future crash in stocks, and a spike higher in treasury yields will give foreign owners of U.S. treasuries, corporate bonds, and stocks every reason to sell. Foreign creditors sell because of a heightened risk of a large decline in the exchange value of the U.S. dollar. Foreign creditors sell and repatriate just some. Gargantuan, asset base that they've accumulated over the past 10 years, well, selling pressure on the dollar would be strong and ongoing. The Fed then would be limited in its ability to hike rates and to defend the dollar due to the other mandates it has on employment and especially inflation. The net international investment position of the U.S. has gone from negative $2.5 trillion in 2010 to negative $14 trillion this year. In other words, non-U.S. investor ownership of U.S. assets exceeds U.S. ownership of foreign assets by $14 trillion. Now, over the past decade, the net inflow of $11.5 trillion in foreign capital into U.S. markets has been a powerful driver of stocks, bonds, and real estate, yet it's rarely publicized. It's made up for the low U.S. household savings rate, last year notwithstanding. It's part of the answer to the question, where does all the money come from to prop up U.S. financial assets when the average U.S. household has meager savings? Well, I agree with Amas that such an environment just can't go on forever. There are practical, political, and national security-related limits as to how much a country's assets can be sold to foreigners to fund imports. Congress is going to eventually realize this. In fact, most probably do already. They just can't say much, if anything, about it publicly because the interests, the special interests that finance their campaigns, both parties. Some foreign creditors will too. And the first to do so will sell and repatriate their capital to get ahead of the risk of capital controls. And even if that stabilizes and flattens over the next decade, it still means roughly $1 to $2 trillion per year would have to come from U.S. domestic savings to keep treasury yield stocks and corporate bond spreads at their current wealth effect promoting levels. $1 to $2 trillion a year. How likely do you think that is? And since a trillion dollar plus surge in household and corporate savings can't materialize, at least without causing a deflationary depression in consumption, the Fed will feel compelled to maintain a $1 trillion or more of annual QE for a long time to come. Tax hike might be debated to cover some of that, but whether they'd be passed, especially in big chunks, is, I think, practically debatable. The unmanageable nature of public and private sector spending, savings, debt, and deficit means that a ton of pressure is going to fall again and again on the Fed to plug gaps. The Fed will be forced into a state of more or less permanent easing then, regardless of the reported inflation. Now, until that dynamic changes, I agree with Amos that the U.S. dollar just can't be relied upon as a store of value. And you know, when the dollar ceases to be a store of value, gold becomes the ultimate investment. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait for the inevitable to happen. Call us today at 1-800-375-4188. Thanks again to Dan Amos for that background information. All right, now, when is a bank too corrupt it should lose its charter? That's my final question of today's program. Pam and Russ Martins remind us in today's Wall Street on Parade that, go back 7 years, January 2014, J.P. Morgan Chase, too big to fail bank, paid $2.6 billion in fines and restitution, signed a, yes, deferred prosecution agreement that Melody talked about recently, and walked away from further criminal charges over its 22-year involvement with, yes, Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Madoff's scheme was the largest in U.S. history, and there have been many of them, with fictitious investment account statements showing his clients held close to $65 billion in securities with his firm. Madoff never actually bought any stocks or other securities, I believe, for his investment clients. The Martin's recent review of federal court filing shows that at the time that J.P. Morgan Chase was deeply involved with Madoff, it was also entangled with another multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme being orchestrated by Thomas Petters. J.P. Morgan Chase's involvement in the Petters case has been largely ignored by the mainstream media. But both the Petters Ponzi scheme and Madoff's collapsed in 2008 during the Great Recession. The Petters fraud collapsed after one of his employees contacted law enforcement officials. And in December, a year later, a Minnesota jury found Petters guilty on all 20 counts of wire fraud, mail fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy. Petters is still serving a 50-year sentence in federal prison in Leavenworth, Kansas. Of course, Madoff died in prison earlier this year. Now, the Martins ask, how is it possible that the largest federally insured bank in the U.S. with thousands of employees engaged in risk management and anti-money laundering and compliance could ever become involved in two of the largest Ponzi schemes in U.S. history over the same period of time, roughly? In the Madoff matter, J.P. Morgan Chase used unaudited financial statements and skipped the required steps of bank due diligence to make $145 million in loans to Madoff's business, at least according to Irving Picard, who served as a trustee of the Madoff's Victims Fund. Now, lawyers for the trustee wrote that from November 2005 through January 2006, what's that, a three-month period? J.P. Morgan Chase loaned that $145 million to Madoff when the bank was on notice of fraudulent activity in Madoff's business account and when, in fact, Madoff's business was insolvent. J.P. Morgan, in fact, provided liquidity to continue the Ponzi scheme, according to Picard. J.P. Morgan Chase and its predecessor banks also extended tens of millions of dollars in loans to Norman Levy and his family so they could invest with the insolvent Madoff. According to Picard, Levy had $188 million in outstanding loans in 1996, which he used to funnel into Madoff investments. Picard's lawyers wrote in court filings that J.P. Morgan Chase referred to these investments as special deals. I can hear Church Lady, wherever she is right now, saying, well, isn't that special? Indeed, these deals were special for all involved. First, Levy enjoyed Madoff's inflated return rates of up to 40% on the money he invested with him. Madoff enjoyed the benefits of large amounts of cash to perpetuate his fraud without being subject J.P. Morgan's Chase due diligence. And the bank itself earned fees on the loan amounts, millions and millions of dollars, and watched the special deals from afar, escaping any real fundamental responsibility for due diligence on Madoff's operation. Critical piece of evidence against Morgan was that despite funneling loans to both Madoff and Levy, the bank advised the rest of its private bank customers not to invest with Bernie Madoff. You've got to be kidding me. Even after another bank detected the activity in the late 90s and reported the transactions to the U.S. Department, the Treasury's Department Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, J.P. Morgan Chase and its predecessor banks failed to file their own mandated suspicious activity reports, known as SARs. The bank not only allowed the activity to continue, but allowed it to increase dramatically in dollar terms. J.P. Morgan's penalty, total of $33.25 million in two separate settlement agreements. And, of course, a deferred prosecution agreement with the Department of Justice. Well, that's a good point to stop, because I don't know, I could go on. That's really exhausting to talk about that kind of outrageousness. That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be off the rest of this week and turn next Tuesday, which will join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners. Have a good evening, and please be safe. Bye-bye.